up on the tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. My guest today is Kyle Miner, who wrote a book, a very good book, called Praying Drunk Stories. It just won the third annual Story Prize Spotlight Award, which is an award given to a collection worthy of a lot of attention. And I have to agree, I think this book is worthy of a lot of attention. You're going to love it, and you're going to enjoy this conversation. So stick around for that. I've been thinking, which is a dangerous thing to do, obviously, I think that I finally figured out that it is indeed turtles all the way down. If there's one thing that I am sure of in my life, in my development intellectually, spiritually, emotionally, whatever, is that it is indeed turtles all the way down. Now, I'm not sure if most of you are familiar with this reference, but just in case, unless there are some of you who don't know to what I'm alluding, if you don't understand my frame of reference, let me give you a brief narrative. It is a story, perhaps a bit apocryphal, that can be found in Stephen Hawking's book, A Brief History of Time, but also in other narratives about physicists. And the story goes that there was a physicist, and he was giving a lecture in a community town hall, and he was talking about the Big Bang and the origin of the universe and the idea of infinite space. And there was this lady in the back in the audience, and she started raising her hand and very Horseshack, like she was going, ooh, ooh, you know, Horseshack from Welcome Back, Kotter, which perhaps is a frame of reference the younger generation won't get. But the physicist giving the lecture can no longer ignore this lady raising her hand, so he takes her questions, and the lady stands up and she says, "That Big Bang theory is a bunch of malarkey. It's ridiculous. And the universe is not infinite. Everyone knows that the universe rests on the back of a giant turtle." So the physicist asks, "Okay, then what is the turtle standing on?" And the lady says, "It's turtles all the way down." Really, Google this. This is a true narrative. And even though this narrative is supposed to show the ignorance of the layperson vis-a-vis the physicist, and you know, frankly, we can't really, unless we understand the language of math, we can't really understand physics. We could just access the metaphors. Even though it's supposed to be about ignorance, I think the story actually has a lot more truth to it than, well, the statement, I think, actually has a lot more truth. The fact is, the universe is indeed located on the back of a turtle. And infinity is turtles all the way down. Because each turtle is a way to articulate reality. And as thinking beings, we can descend and ascend from turtle to turtle, because if turtles all the way down, then it has to be turtles all the way up as well. Turtles are infinite. And you can find that within each layer of reality, whether it's scientific layer, the spiritual layer, the archetypal, the emotional, that they are all articulations of the same equation. What can be articulated in one system can be articulated in another. It turtles all the way down. William Blake, the great mystic poet, he's the one who wrote, "Tiger, tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night. What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry?" I love that line, fearful symmetry, because it describes the muscles, the symmetrical muscles and body of the tiger. And sometimes I stand in front of the mirror and I flex and I call it my fearful symmetry. But Blake, William Blake, says that all religions are the same. Now, I'm not talking about weird religions that last a few years when the disciples die or they move into retirement homes. I mean, the world's most lasting religions are all the same, with a change in metaphor and narrative. Jesus Christ dying on a cross is a metaphor. It reveals to us the grace of God, the loving energy of the divine, something you find in all religions. All religions are the same, just the metaphors change. Now, I'm not saying that all religious people are the same, although intolerant religious zealots are the same in spite of their religion. The Christian crusaders who slaughtered anyone they considered an infidel are certainly similar to religious zealots today justifying murder and terrorism. I'm not saying religious people are the same. I'm saying religions are the same, and the energy behind them is the same, and energy cannot be destroyed. Now, I know I'm mixing metaphors here. I'm mixing William Blake with the first law of thermodynamics, the law of conservation of energy. I'm using one system and mixing it with the other to describe reality. But the energy behind the religion is what is true. It's the metaphors that differ from turtle to turtle. We cannot understand reality without the use of metaphor, and the turtle is a metaphor. On some sophisticated level on which I will never stand, on the back of a turtle on which I will never stand, even mathematical explanations of reality are metaphors. To understand reality, we need metaphor, and that's why fiction and poetry are so important to human culture, because of the metaphorical explanation of reality. So maybe the lady who thinks that the universe rests on the back of a turtle is really saying that no matter how we articulate reality, we are struggling to articulate the same truths. Same truth, different turtle. It's turtles all the way down. The truth is, Kyle Miner's stories exist on layers and layers of reality. There's lots of turtles in this book. It's a blend of religion, science fiction, sadness. So join us. Let's talk to Kyle Miner about Praying Drunk. Kyle Miner is a columnist at Salon, The Nation, and HTML Giant. His work has appeared in Esquire, Best American Mystery Stories, Best American Non-Required Reading, 20-something Essays by 20-something Writers, and 40 Stories, The New Voices from Harper Perennial. He is the recipient of the 2012 Iowa Review Prize, the Tara Kroger Prize for Short Fiction, and in 2006 was named a Best New Voice by Random House. His latest book is a collection of stories called Praying Drunk. Kyle, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you.
And I got a copy of Praying Drunk, Stories and Questions, and I've been reading it, and I tell you, man, I love this book. The language is amazing. And the book can just absolutely go anywhere, yet it's rooted in a character's need and desire. And it's just a fantastic book. And it just won the third annual Story Prize Spotlight Award. It's given for a short story collection worthy of additional attention. So congratulations on that award.
Thank you. I'm pretty happy about it.
And has it given the book additional attention?
It has, actually, although not so much from readers, but from people who are interested in maybe publishing the next book, and from publishers in other countries and things like that, which surprised me.
Oh,
I was really excited about all of that.
Yeah, well, you do take a lot of risks in this book. In fact, even the subtitle, Stories, Questions, I love that, because not only do the stories raise questions themselves, but you even have sections, Q&A sections, which I think are fantastic. I noticed that subtitle doesn't exist on the front cover. It says Praying Drunk Stories, but when you go inside, it says Praying Drunk Stories Questions. Is the full title Stories Questions, or is it just Stories?
Well, in the manuscript version, I put Stories and Questions. I mean, for the reasons that you said, the stories in many ways are extended attempts to reckon with questions, and then there are stories that proceed as questions and answers. Also, because a few of the stories in the book were originally published as essays, and the book sort of did away with the genre distinctions among all of those forms. I just decided the path to the things I was interested in didn't exist exclusively with fiction or with nonfiction or with poetry or with anything, and wanted to have the freedom to move around without declaring what it was.
And was it the publisher's decision not to include questions on the cover?
I guess so. You know, I don't really understand a lot about how all that works, but there were 8 or 9 different versions of the cover at one point, and one just rose. So I don't know how intentional that choice was or wasn't.
My last book is called Hotel Juarez, Stories, Rooms, and Loops. And I wanted Rooms and Loops to be included after Stories because I didn't think they were, quite frankly, all stories. Some of them were rooms and loops, and I won't get into what I meant by that. But I was very fortunate that the publisher that I ended up going with just went with it. They go, okay. And what I love about praying drunk is, and you mentioned this kind of before, is that it makes little distinction between fiction and memory, i.e. nonfiction. And I'm reminded of a quote by Antonin Artaud where he says, "We have the right to lie, but not about the truth of the matter." I'm wondering, how challenging was it for you to negotiate between this idea of fact or this idea of fiction and this idea of memoir?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you accidentally said memory instead of nonfiction.
Oh, it wasn't an accident.
It's like a really beautiful way to think about it, actually, because if you think about what memory is,
right,
it's kind of an attempt to put together what all that was. And in some ways, it's closer to the spirit of what a fiction writer does than it is to some of the connotations that the word nonfiction has, which tend to be bound up in journalistic ideas,
right,
of objectivity, which is a thing that I'm not even sure exists in the world. There's not like a pristine objective thing somewhere that we can just reach out and grab. We're all trying to make sense of everything with all the resources that we bring to bear, our personal history and our prejudices and our attempts to be noble and our peccadillos and all these things that aren't reconcilable, you know, and we have gaps in our information and things that we misunderstand. And so what I noticed over time is that I seem to be writing through a series of obsessions, and often I would find I was writing the same things over and over again and coming out in different places. When I tried to remember, I'd remember things in different ways, and I had no way to reclaim, you know, the central memory, if there was one. And I was thinking a lot about these traveling preachers that used to come to the Southern Baptist Church I went to when I was a little kid. It was a hellfire and brimstone kind of place. And they talked about heaven. They said that when you got there, you would just spend all your time like singing the same songs that you sing in church,
right,
you know, gathered around the throne. And that sounded terrible to me, really boring.
Right.
And I figured if I made it in there, probably I would just end up doing the same thing I do now, which is like sitting in a chair trying to figure out what to do with the troubling things about the past and going over and over and over it. And I realized that's what the book is. It's a reckoning of that sort, and maybe that's who the narrator is too.
You know, if I die right now and I go to a place where everybody's just singing and wearing white, I'd be thinking, I want a beer. Where can I find a beer?
Where are all the interesting people?
And I'd probably end up in a smelly bar that that smells like still cigarettes and beer and spend the rest of my life in hell. This idea of memory, I mean, it's very clear that you're accessing memory, but what I love about your approach is that you're not doing it in a very linear way. You're not trying to recall facts. And there's this one story with a repeated line, and the repeated line is, "I'm 12 years old, standing beneath a star fruit tree." And I love that line. It keeps anchoring back to that line, and then it goes in other places. It goes to amazing images. It goes to that idea of fire and brimstone. You just touch on everything, but that keeps pulling it back and pulling it back. Was that a conscious use of repetition, as if you were writing a poem, or is it just something that just kind of came out as you were accessing memories?
I had this friend in graduate school. Her name was Ayanna Wilson. She was from Trinidad. And she wrote this essay one time called Sour Mangoes. It was about a sour mango tree. She never cared much for it, you know. She just turned it into class and it went away. This is when I was at Ohio State in graduate school. And I just kept thinking about that thing. And then one day I was having lunch with her and I was like, where'd you get the idea to build that essay around that tree? And she said that she had been talking to this guy, and he said, you know, if you're having trouble getting to an emotion, you should just find like a plant in the front yard, right about that. And like whatever you're really preoccupied will immediately start to attach to that. And I was having similar trouble because I was trying to write about this childhood bully, but I was doing it by trying to annotate the book of Ecclesiastes, you mm-hmm. know, like in footnotes, like I was under the spell of David Foster Wallace. And I was like, well, maybe I should just write about the tree. And, you know, as it happened, there was this important tree. that there's a starfruit tree. I went to school on this campus that was reclaimed from a used car salesman's estate. And then when the city grew around it, he sold it and it became a school. And he had imported all these exotic plants from all over the world. And there's a starfruit tree, you know, and I go there every morning and I pick a fruit from it. I found out later, this isn't in Praying Drunk, but I found out later that the starfruit actually has a neurotoxin in it. Like if you ate enough of it, you could kill all your brain cells. weirdly, it may actually have the property of dulling pain in a way. And I thought it was so interesting that at the most painful time in my life, I was every morning eating this fruit that may have had the property that it dulled pain. So, I mean, that's kind of how it happened. Of course, I was studying poetry at the time, and I was very much taken with the idea that emotion rises from the relationship between a pattern and the variation that you throw into the pattern. And I was very dissatisfied with the short fiction that I was mostly reading, which mostly was coming down from the minimalists from the 80s, Raymond Carver, people like that. I was a lot more excited with what I was seeing in poetry, with the kind of a restlessness with regard to form and telling stories in different ways. And so I don't think I could point to one thing as the origin for that, but I think all of that was in the process at the time.
Your book encompasses desire. It encompasses, fear, insecurity, that poor kid, which I suppose is you because you name him Minor, being picked on by McKinnick. Yet there's these questions of heaven and hell, and I notice there's even some idea of physics. In fact, I think a lot of times the physics metaphors are pretty powerful. Do you read physics for fun?
No, I don't understand physics at all.
Yes, you do. You understand a lot more than you think you do. Let me ask you a question about we have the beginning story and then we have the ending story. In the beginning, the uncle has blown off his head, and in the ending story, the nephew has blown off his head. And I'm wondering how this frame came about. Did it just happen, or was it crafted, or was it something you realized later? Oh my God, these things are encompassing, the entire book. How did that go about? How did that happen?
No, I just went through like a 5 or 10 year period of my life in which everybody was blowing off their heads.
Jeez.
but all these people I knew, all these people in my family, suicide after suicide, and then the rupture that would inevitably follow when people tried to figure out what to do with their pain. And so, it was just organic. It wasn't a plan. Everything about the book that looks like a design was the last choice of the book,
All right.
I mean, I always thought of the book as a document of a lot of failures to address these preoccupations, which were so difficult and so dark. And then one day I just realized this is what it is, man. And this is like, this form is true to what the material is concerned with, because ultimately there aren't the kind of answers that would comfort so much when it comes to problems that are that, well, there's so much beyond our ability to solve, and you try to reckon with them, but the reckoning is always incomplete and always seems like a failure. And that's what it is.
Wow.
And so that's why the book has such a weird form.
There's a section called Q&A, and I call it a section because I'm not quite sure you could call it a story, but one of the questions is, what is the purpose of this book? And the answer is, a catalog of stories and sadness, beginnings and endings, the stuff of childhood, death. Nothing new can happen here, so all you do is think of the days of life when possibility hadn't been ripped from you forever, when anything can happen, and wondered why so much was squandered, so much wasted. Does that describe the book?
Yeah, and I remember writing that because that's one of the last things I wrote in the book. Yeah, I was thinking also, I had just read a story by John Updike that he wrote almost before he died called The Walk with Elizon. And it's a story in which it begins at the end with these old people going to a high school reunion, but it ends with this moment where this man and woman, I mean, not even a man and a woman, they're like two high school seniors, are going on a walk, and as they walk, they it seems as though anything could happen, right? And they don't know the end of the story, but the reader knows the end of the story, and the end of the story is nothing happened between them. But at that one moment, anything could have happened, right? Mm-hmm. Their whole life was ahead of them, and it could have been exciting. They could have been together. They could have found love, but nothing. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about that.
It's a powerful book, and everything seems incredibly organic, no matter where the book goes. Nothing is forced in this, but it goes everywhere. So congratulations on Praying Drunk, and thank you for joining us, Kyle, on Words on a Wire.
Thank you.
On Poetic License today, we have a young writer and scholar from California. His name's Joseph Rios, and he is going to share a few words in honor of Michelle Cerros, the Chicana writer who recently died.
As I write this, it's officially been 1 week since Michelle died. I'm beginning to understand and accept that my friend is gone. No more goofy text messages, no coded references to some old TV show, Lucy, X-Files, or Columbo. No more sudden secret missions from Doña Cerros. No new orders for her bespectacled joven. And these being the names she assigned each of us, two characters in an ever-lengthening story I didn't imagine would end so soon. She left us on Sunday, January 4th, the same night we celebrated her with a well-attended Floricanto at UC Berkeley. Friends and loved ones drove in from different parts of California. Others from all over bid on art pieces donated by Sherry Moraga, Esther Hernandez, Lalo Alcaraz, Melanie Cervantes, and others. When we planned this event, we knew Michelle's condition was far along. About the end of November, Antonio came to Susie Huerta, Jennifer Mora, and I, and asked if we'd put something together. He wanted it as soon as possible because, well, we all knew she was approaching the end. I don't yet know what to make of the timing, and I'm not sure that I believe in Providence, but to have her go that very same night? Being in that room with all that love and laughter, none of us could have predicted it. I've had 1 week to myself. Sometimes I want to call Michelle's phone and let it ring until it goes to her voicemail. It's a strange thing to come to mind, I know, but if you've ever done this, then you know why it's worthwhile. You know that any time you call her and she's away from her phone, you are treated to a recording of Michelle in an exaggerated robot voice saying, "You have reached 212-366," and so on. And if you haven't heard it, the prank will probably get by you on the first or second time around. It's just too good. And if you're new to Michelle and her antics, you'll ask yourself, "Wait, was that her? That couldn't have been her. Michelle Cerros, the poet, the published author? No, let me check the number and call again." And don't worry, your instincts aren't misplaced. It's just that there aren't many people, well, I don't know of any other person who's as willing to go as far as she did to create laughter in those unexpected places. And one of her favorite holidays was Father's Day, and not for the reason you'd expect. Weeks in advance, she would make a list of her male friends and then call them, pretending to be their unclaimed children. In a kid's voice, she'd say, "My mom said to ask you if you remember the Red Hot Chili Peppers concert from 1999. You met my mom there, and I was born a year later." She made dozens of terrified 20 and 30-something-year-old men pee their pants, mulling over what ifs and maybe could have been. And for Lady Cerros, every interaction was an opportunity to create that magic. For Michelle, the everyday was transformed into some kind of adventure. And on some fortuitous occasions, I was brought along for the ride. And sometimes I would provide the ride. I'd pull up in my beat-up 99 Ford Ranger in Berkeley or Oxnard, and we'd take off here or there and anywhere Doña Cerros wanted to go. And the first time she got in my truck, she pulled down the visor, all disappointed. "You must not have a lot of girls in your truck," she said. "Look, you don't even have a mirror over here." And she shook her head while she searched through her purse for a mirror so she could touch up her face. We might have been headed to her husband's restaurant, Flacco's, or the Temescal pool, or a poetry reading, or a comedy show, or a movie premiere. I can't really remember. And hosting this fundraiser for her and the days that followed gave me the opportunity to recount these many tales of Doña Cerros and her bespectacled hoven. How we met that one time on the back of a poetry reading at Moe's Books. She was wearing some furry collared jacket and couldn't stop talking about her new cell phone cover that looked like a cassette tape. "Have you ever seen one like this?" she asked. "Do you even remember cassettes? How old are you again?" She spilled question upon question while Francisco Alarcón read his poems over our rudeness. Or that time she taught me how to properly pose for a photo after the Paul Mooney show. How she lectured about my wrinkled and stained shirt and how neither of these were the mark of a young poet and man of letters. Oh, and that time I took Susie to meet Michelle and Esther Hernandez for that one fateful and serendipitous lunch at Flacco's. Should I remind Antonio that we haven't yet paid for any of our vegan taquitos? Looking back now, there are many stories to be told. I could recount the story of how Doña Cerros led me into the fields of California's central coast and showed me how to read poetry to the freshly tilled furrows of Gilroy. I could tell you how I will always remember the smell of that particular rain and the mud it made on her gold slippers. I could tell you how Lady Cerros convinced Piper Kerman and a group of her fans that I was Michelle's illegitimate son coming to meet my father for the first time, and that my father happened to be featured in conversation with Piper that same evening at Stanford. They all went for it. They all went for it so easily. Or should I tell you the tale of Lady Cerros and the uninspired burrito? I could tell you how she took on Chipotle armed only with a felt pen and her husband's biodegradable to-go cups. I could tell you how she got us to pick up our swords, too, and made us, well, made me, believe in the value of my own stories, even when, and especially when, the rest of the world does not feel the same way. As a mentor, that's what she leaves with me. A firm and unmoving belief that a writer's most important gift to the world is their story. That as Chicanos, our stories matter. And that these stories must be told in our voices, on our own terms. For Words on a Wire, I'm Joseph Rios.
Thank you for joining me for another edition of Words on a Wire. I'd like to thank my guest, Kyle Miner. His book is called Praying Drunk, and I'd especially like to thank Joseph Rios for that wonderful homage to a fantastic, brilliant writer whose loss is a great tragedy. Thank you, Joseph. I'd like to thank Norma Martinez, our producer, and I'd like to thank you, and I'll see you next week on another edition. And don't forget, the next book you read as you sit on the back of whatever turtle you choose may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place for me. A comedy of error.